This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, wow, what a delightful conversation I had with Roger Ibbotson. If you don't know who he is, well, you need to become a little more familiar with financial histories. He is one of the founding fathers about modern thoughts on asset allocation, portfolio management, valuation, factor. Go down the list of a million things. He really was instrumental in the development and expansion of CRISP, which is the giant stock database originally out of the University of Chicago. Ibbotson Associates, he's on the board of advisors at Dimensional Funds. His curriculum vitae is pages and pages long. He was extremely generous with his time and shared all sorts of fascinating things with us. If you are at all a stock market wonk, if you are at all interested in why some stocks go up and others don't, then you're going to find this conversation to be absolutely fascinating. So with no further ado, my conversation with Yale University's Roger Ibbotson. This week, I have an extra special guest. His name is Roger Ibbotson. He is a professor at the Yale School of Management, where he is professor of practice emeritus of finance. He is also the founder and chairman of Ibbotson Associates, which was sold not too long ago to Morningstar. He is on the board of directors of Dimensional Fund Advisors. He is the chairman and CIO of Zebra Capital Management, an equity investment and hedge fund manager. He has also taught for many years and served as executive director for the Center for Research in Security Prices, better known as CRISP. He's the author of numerous books, including Investment Markets, Gaining the Performance Advantage, and Global Investing, The Professional's Guide to the World of Capital Markets. Roger Ibbotson, welcome to Bloomberg.
Great to be here.
I've been looking forward to having this conversation with you for a long, long time. I've certainly been familiar with Ibbotson Associates since you founded them back in 1977. But let's go back to your days when you got your PhD from Chicago. What was the state of the world in finance like when you first entered the markets?
Well, you know, it was really, things were happening at the University of Chicago. And ultimately, many of the people there got Nobel Prizes for what went on. But if you just take us back a few years before that, finance really hadn't developed as an academic subject. It was security analyst or how to pick a stock or something like that. And then we started really developing a whole theory of how finance works. And I got to say, I had great people to work with there. My chairman of my committee when I wrote my dissertation was Eugene Fama. He won a Nobel Prize. I had him on my committee, Merton Miller. He won a Nobel Prize. Myron Scholes won a Nobel Prize. Fisher Black, you have to be alive to win a Nobel Prize. And
yes,
Unfortunately, he died before that, but he certainly would have. So it was really a tremendous group of people to work with.
That's a 1926 Yankees murderer's row of Nobel laureates there.
Yes. It was a wonderful time going on. So so many different discoveries were taking place.
You mentioned that the study of finance really hadn't developed academically as much as it has since. Tell us about the Center for Research in Security Prices, for CRISP. How did that come about, and what was your involvement?
So the Center for Research and Security Prices, we call it CRISP, C-R-S-P. Well, CRISP was really set up by James Lurie and Larry Fisher, and they were collecting data on the stock market returns. And their data started in 1926, and now you see a lot of things start in 1926. So they were collecting this data, and that's what started the center. And I got to say, once they published this data, they never kept it quite up to date. But once they published it, people were so interested because they had no idea what actually had happened in the stock market. They didn't actually have any sense for how stock market returns were like. In fact, they kind of remembered the 30s and how terrible it was and so forth. And they knew things were better lately, but they still didn't realize the high returns that actually had happened in the stock market.
That's quite fascinating. So when you say this was not much of an academic study, are you really referring to the fact that previous to the creation of CRISP, there wasn't a whole lot of data that could be analyzed, at least not consistent data in anything approaching a well-structured way?
Yeah, CRISP really put the data on the map. And then when I got my PhD there, but I actually stayed on as a professor. And when I stayed on, I became the executive director of CRISP. So I was in, I guess, helping to put the data together. And it was really not only the University of Chicago that was using that data, but all the other universities were really using that data. So this suddenly finance became an empirical subject that people could study.
That's the word I was hunting for. It had no empiricism previous. This was what years did you begin with CRISP?
Well, I got there as a student in 1968 and became a faculty member in 1974. And I guess I became executive director, I don't remember, a few years after that, of the center. But I was always involved with CRISP from the start because I was always interested in data. And in fact, I got a job while I was getting my PhD in the investment office of the university.
Mm-hmm. And the endowment, in other words.
The endowment, right. Mm-hmm. I was a consultant to the office, and one of the things they asked me as a consultant was, what do we do with this bond portfolio? And I said, well, I can manage that. And so they actually, as a PhD student, I was actually managing the University of Chicago bond portfolio.
And how large was that at the time?
Well, these numbers were not large in today's terms. Right. A couple hundred million, you know.
But still, a PhD student is like, okay, congratulations, you're running a few hundred million dollars. That's not nothing, especially in the late 60s.
Yeah, it was a great thing to do. And it gets back to what you were talking about. When people, once I was running the bond portfolio, people would ask me, when are Fisher and Laurie going to update their study? Because the first data came out and it went from 1926 to 1960, and then it was the 1926 to 1965, and then 1968. But this was 72, 73, and people were asking, when we want to see the updated data. And I would ask Larry Fisher when it's going to get updated, and Larry would give me a date, but the date would go by and it wouldn't get done. And so this is when I really took the ball by our hands. I worked with Rex Sinkfield, who was a student of mine at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to put data, not literally all the we used certainly the Center for Research Prices, but we put some quicker data together to get a sense of what something up to date, actually. And we brought it up to date actually through 1976 at the time.
So that brings us to 1977, which not coincidentally is when you launch Ibbotson Associates. Tell us about what motivated you to go out and hang your own shingle.
Well, it was stocks, bonds, bills, and inflation. I was an assistant professor, mm-hmm. and we had just published Stocks, Bonds, Bills, and Inflation, first as a couple of journal articles, and one which was on the past and one actually predicted the future, long term, but then also as a monograph from the CFA Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was so interested that I was getting inundated with letters coming in, CEOs asking me for information and response of this question and that question. And I was at I barely had a secretary. I did, had a part of a secretary, and I didn't know what to do with all these letters from these CIOs, CEOs, and CIOs, and mm-hmm. and so forth. So I started hiring a couple of people to help me out with this, and that's what caused me to actually start Ibbotson Associates. I had plenty of business at the start because so many people were actually requesting things from me.
You sold Ibbotson Associates and advisors to Morningstar back in 2006, pretty good timing before the tide went out in 08, 09. What was that process like? They're a pretty big shop, Morningstar. How did that transaction go?
Well, in 2006, by that time I was already at Yale School of Management as a professor in practice there. But in 2006, We had 150 people at Ibbotson Associates
with
offices in Chicago, New York, and Tokyo, actually. Mm-hmm. But still, we were very small compared to Morningstar.
Yeah, they're giant. Also in Chicago, right? Aren't they?
They weren't very far. They were just, we were like two firms that were somewhat similar.
Uh-huh.
That were only a couple blocks away from each other.
That's a pretty natural fit that the large Morningstar will acquire the smaller Ibbotson in the same hometown.
Actually, I got to say though, we were around first because I remember when Joe Mansueto in the 1980s came to a few of our holiday parties and things like that. And But I got to say, you have to give Joe Mansueto credit. Morningstar really took off and grew. We were growing fast too, but nothing like they were growing.
Well, you focused on data about markets generally. They focused specifically on mutual funds, and that became a giant growth area for them, especially with the ERISA laws and 401k coming up in the early 70s.
Well, everybody was in. ERISA was more. 401k really started developing in the really in 1980s. First, it was those defined benefit pension mm-hmm. plans, the DB plans, and we worked with them to some extent. But Morningstar actually picked the retail end of it with the 401k right. market and the mutual funds. Yes,
yeah.
And so, but we were two very fast growing firms that were alongside each other for a couple decades in Chicago before they actually bought us out.
Quite intriguing. Let's talk a little bit about CRISP, and we mentioned earlier you worked on the 1926 to present database of stock market returns, but not too long ago, a new historical database was added for the New York Stock Exchange going back to 1815, straight up to the original 1926 date. What did you learn from that database about equity returns and about volatility?
Well, you know, first of all, we had to hand collect all that data back to.
What do you mean hand collect?
Well, it was
it's newspaper.
It was in
clippings?
The Yale Beinecke Library where you had to look at microfiche and old newspapers.
Really?
Of the New York Shipping and Commercial Chronicle, and it was mostly about which ships were coming in to the harbor, but they also listed the New York stock market prices.
So how do you error check that to make sure that nobody makes a transcription error? That sounds like, you know, a century of data. It's really easy to make a mistake with that.
Well, it is, and I'm not saying there's no possible mistakes in there, because it had to be hand-collected. But there aren't that many companies in the early days
right.
either. So we're not talking about the 3,000 stocks that we might be talking about today. We're talking about, less than 100 stocks over most of this period.
Wow. Quite fascinating. So what did you learn about equity returns and volatility?
Well, you know, that data in the 1800s was kind of unusual because stocks tended to be issued around 100.
Right.
It almost looked like you were looking at bond data.
Because everything is trading at par or a little above or a
little
below.
Well, yeah, they may trade in the range of 50 to 200 or something,
right.
but
they kind
of looked like bonds, and we had to keep on investigating further and further to find out where are these are stocks, aren't they? You know, and they were, of course, stocks, but they looked like bonds. They weren't that volatile.
Uh-huh.
They weren't, of course, the trading wasn't anything like the trading today.
Not a lot of volume and trade by appointment only, or did they actually?
Of course, the Buttonwood agreement. You know, they were traded on the curb and then eventually inside. But so they were continuously traded, but not and even the volume wasn't even recorded at that time. You know, but we did get the last prices.
Huh. That's quite fascinating. So, you know, CRISP is very often associated with factor-based investing and equity risk premium. What can you tell us about that? What do we know today about the equity risk premium that we didn't know in the pre-CRISP days?
Back in the theory was developing in the 1960s, especially with the in the 1950s and 60s. We had the Harry Markowitz came out with his portfolio theory in 1952. It was at the University of Chicago, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say, it was kind of interesting because at the first, they didn't even, Milton Friedman was reluctant to give Harry Markowitz a PhD for this because he wasn't sure this was economics.
Okay, so you've just lowered my estimation of Milton Friedman a notch. How do you not? My hindsight bias is Harry Markowitz. Of course you give him a PhD, but I guess that's just hindsight bias, isn't it?
Yeah, well, of course, Harry has a Nobel Prize too,
right.
And so, and then we had the capital asset pricing models coming along, in 1965 with Bill Sharp and mm-hmm. John Lintner. And by the way, Harry Markowitz and Bill Sharp, they're still around today. We can talk to them and so
sure.
forth.
Sharp is out in Northern California. And where is Markowitz these days?
He's in Southern California.
Southern California. So at the University of Chicago, when you get an office as a faculty member, do they give you like a key to the office and a Nobel Prize? How does that work? Everybody in that faculty has that. That's a lot of jewelry in that faculty department.
Well, actually, Bill Sharp wasn't ever at the University mm-hmm. of Chicago, so not every Nobel Prize went to the University of Chicago people.
But you've named seven or eight, I'm not counting Bill.
Yes.
You've gone through a whole bunch of them. What was it like working with that crew? That is some amazing list of advisors.
Well, we did know, we did recognize that things were going on, that this was a special place.
Mm-hmm.
We could see that. I mean, it wasn't like we were surprised afterwards or something. I guess
right.
we're surprised about the Nobel Prizes, perhaps, but we weren't surprised that we were the center of thought leadership at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we were theoretically understanding is risk premiums.
Mm-hmm.
So not only in the stock market where there's an equity risk premium, but also in the bond market where there's an interest rate or horizon risk premium, that long bonds have higher yields than short bonds.
Most of the time.
And then there's a default premium,
right.
The fact that if you buy lower grade bonds, they tend to have higher yields, but even higher returns than higher grade bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So you had all these different risk premiums. And that's what caused me to put this stocks, bonds, bills, and inflation together, this data, because it was really the purpose of seeing what were the historical payoffs of stocks versus bonds, stocks versus treasury bills, bonds versus treasury bills versus inflation, bonds that could default versus treasury bonds. All these things were risk premiums, and the purpose originally was to measure these risk premiums and see how they had done historically, because we had the theory.
Let's see if it works.
Yes, and it did. Of course, they had great payoffs, and that's part of the reason why it became so well-known so fast, because everybody could now see the numbers of the kinds of things that we kind of knew were there, but we hadn't seen the numbers.
You could quantify risk and apply it to future expected returns.
Well, that's the other thing. These were historical, but the other paper we had, this is with Ibbotson and Sinkfield, the other paper we had back in 1976 was a projection of what would happen and how you could go out the next 25 years, using the last 50 years to extrapolate out into the next 25 years. And we're not literally just extrapolating just the pure numbers, but we're extrapolating the risk premiums. And those risk premiums were extrapolated out to come up with these forecasts, which actually turned out to be almost on the money, forecasting what would happen by the year 2000.
So of those four, stocks, bonds, bills, and inflation, which do you find is the easiest to forecast and which is the hardest?
Well, the hardest to forecast is always the stock market, because mm-hmm. there's so much volatility, there's so much noise. It's a scary place to be. That's why it has that equity risk premium.
Exactly. And which is the easiest to forecast?
Actually, it would be the, I would say, in a derivative form, it would be the real interest rate, the difference between inflation and treasury bills.
Uh-huh.
But of course, treasury bills are mostly moving the yields are, and bond yields in general, are mostly higher or lower because of the expected inflation. So when you're in high inflationary periods, you have high bond yields. And when you're in low inflationary periods, you have low bond yields. Like we have very low bond yields today, but we have very low inflation. So a very large part of a bond yield is the expected inflation. And so if you, we know it at every point in time what the inflation is, and that's usually a pretty good indication of what the expected inflation is going to be. As you go further out, you can, you can't forecast it quite as well, but at least in the near term, you have a pretty good idea of what expected inflation will be, and therefore you have a pretty good idea what these yields on bonds are going to be.
So you're the perfect person to ask a question about that we've been debating internally in the office, isn't it? Back and forth as to should stocks have a higher valuation these days for a variety of reasons. But I'm going to ask it differently. It costs nothing to trade today. It's practically free. You could buy mutual funds or ETFs for practically nothing. When you look at the historical returns, and let's call equity 8 to 10% with dividends reinvested, you're paying a lot more for a portfolio. You're paying more for transactions. This was, go back before discount brokerage. It was not cheap to buy or sell something. How does that figure into historical returns, or on in a large enough portfolio, even those higher prices aren't all that relevant?
Well, it may mean that the valuations should be higher because the trading costs are not as high. Anything that's, and I've certainly studied liquidity, risk is one big consideration, but liquidity is probably the second most important consideration.
Liquidity.
Yes. The more liquid something is, the more valuable it is. The less liquid, the less valuable it is. And but the counter to this, of course, is that something that's less liquid might have a lower valuation, but a higher expected return.
Ah, very, very, very interesting. So you are currently a professor at Yale. You spent time at the University of Chicago. Let's talk a little bit about academia and the real world. And you've moved pretty comfortably back and forth between the two. What is the difference between how ideas get applied in the business world? I probably shouldn't call it the real world, but the business world versus the scholarly application of ideas at a place like Chicago or Yale.
Well, you know, there used to be a big gap in time. I remember like studying, as an example, duration on bonds, where the duration was developed around 1940, and I was managing a bond portfolio for the University of Chicago at the time, and I was using duration, and I could figure out. With duration, you could figure out easily in your head how much, if the yield changed, how much the price of a bond would change. And but nobody knew that in the 1970s.
Really?
Yes. And I gave a talk on that, I remember, and it drew a large crowd, but it wasn't new material. It was merely stating something that was known, I guess, academically, but not known in the business world or the real world. And so
giant arbitrage opportunity, isn't it?
We're talking about 30, 40 years of delay before something kind of caught on, and even though it was a very simple concept. So I think that that time, though, has dramatically shrunk now. There is a connection. All my life, I guess, I've been trying to break that connection down. In fact, the title I have, you've read these long titles that I have at Yale University as a professor in the practice of finance. That is a title that actually is a professor rank, but not tenured, but it allows me to have business activities on the side.
And understood.
So ordinarily you're constrained as a professor. You can't do a lot of business activities on the side. But with this title, I can, and I guess in the end I'd not tenured, so I don't go to the committee meetings as many as the committee meetings anyway. I still have to go to a lot of them.
So you're identifying that effectively that bonds are mispriced relative to changes in interest rates. Was there an investment opportunity to arbitrage those prices relative to where they're supposed to be?
This was, of course, in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
So not today. I don't think you find these kind of possibilities, but you did find distortions in the 1970s, and so it was one of the things I did. Now, of course, the bond market has dramatically changed.
Much more efficient than it was back then.
And all the markets have become much more efficient since they were back then, because when something is discovered, the financial literature is not something that just academics read. It's something that the business world reads, and so now things are almost immediately implemented. I don't know what the lag would be between, it wouldn't even be 5 years between what's discovered and what actually goes into practice.
Ed Thorpe wrote about the arbitrage opportunity between equities and warrants, and nobody was tracking them. There was a giant gap, and that also took a good couple of years before everybody else caught on. And for a while, it was easy money, and then that arbitrage went away.
And it particularly went away with the Black-Scholes options model, which could price everything very accurately.
From warrants to options to any derivative relative to the underlying.
Yes, I was in at the University of Chicago with Fisher Black and Myron Scholes there right after they developed it, and before they published it. I said to them, why don't
we should trade on this?
Yes, I suggested that. I actually bought a seat on the CBOE. Uh-huh. I had a seat on the CBOE, and I didn't go down there myself to trade. I sent a trader down there, but I was trading at it. So I was trading on it for a while.
Using their model
after it was published. It didn't matter that it was published, because at first the Black-Scholes model, with all its log normal distributions and continuous time, was complicated enough that you could hand it out on a piece of paper to people.
Nobody would get it.
Right. But what did happen not long after I started trading these was
people figured it out?
Well, more than that, Fisher Black put it up in the members' lounge of the and a computer system in the CBOE. So my game was over.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your game and in the real world as opposed to, or in the asset management world as opposed to the theoretical academic world. Maybe that's a better way to describe it. You're chairman and chief investment officer of Zebra Capital Management. What do you do at Zebra? What sort of strategies do you invest in? And how do you take the academic theories that you work on and apply it to actual management of assets and capital?
We have a new monograph. I have a new monograph with the CFA Institute. It's called Popularity, A Bridge Between Classical and Behavioral Finance. And this monograph is co-authored with Tom Idzorek and Paul Kaplan and James Shong. They're all three authors from Morningstar and myself. Mm-hmm. But it's on popularity. And really, popularity is the main concept, the principle that we manage the money at Zebra Capital. Popularity, it comes down to something you can kind of easily understand.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get a copy of the monograph. It's not expensive. You can buy it on Amazon for $22, I think. And you can get it, download it for free, I think, at the ICFA Institute.
Mm-hmm.
So
CFAinstitute.org. Here it is.
Perhaps you have to be a member, have to be a CFA member in some form to get the access to it. But it's free for the membership anyway.
So when you talk about popularity, what does that mean in actual terms of investment? How do you apply popularity to deploying capital?
So anything that is popular tends to have a higher price.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that is unpopular tends to have a lower price. So think of two assets that have the same cash flows, but one of them is popular.
That'll be more expensive than one that's unpopular.
That's right.
So are you long the unpopular, short the popular, or how do you do that trade?
You're ready to go here.
Okay. Well, yes. It makes sense. So it's a hedged position, and you're even if they both go up, the theory is the cheaper one will go up more than the expensive one, or vice versa. If they both go down, the cheaper one will go down less than the expensive one. And you do this across how many different asset classes? Is it just equities? No bonds, no bills.
At Zebra Capital, we just do it with equities. But the concept applies to anything. Mm-hmm. And it's really getting people to think differently about capital markets. Because, for example, in the capital asset pricing model, it's systematic risk or beta risk that's unpopular. And therefore, any stock that has high systematic risk, high beta risk, is supposed to have a higher expected return,
right,
according to the capital asset pricing model.
But I sense you disagree with that.
I don't necessarily disagree with that, but that's only one aspect of popularity.
Okay.
Risk is unpopular, but there are a lot of other things that are popular or unpopular, and one of them we've already talked about. I talked about liquidity, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So liquidity is popular.
Do you pay a premium for more liquid stocks than illiquid stocks?
Yes.
Or said differently, do you get a discount for illiquid stocks?
Yes. And of course, it's also obviously true in other markets. And you can see it more directly in the bond market, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Or at the most extreme case, think of the treasury yield. There's an on-the-run treasury yield where you buy the most liquid security with a certain maturity, and then there's an off the run, and there's a spread between those of 10 or 20 basis points between the on the run and the off the run yields. So it's just a matter of one being more liquid than the other, and we're not talking about much difference here. The on the run things may be trading every minute or every few seconds even, whereas the off the run might be trading every few minutes, but even small amounts of liquidity might make differences in how you get into differences of expected return.
So is that one element of the thinking that goes into the portfolio, or do you similarly create paired trades with a liquid versus an illiquid stock? You're buying something at a discount and shorting something at a premium. And I don't want to ask you to give away all your secrets, but I'm trying to get a handle on how you use these different aspects of popularity.
Well, they're not paired because we're just a whole bundle of stocks on the long side that are less popular, and a whole bundle of another stocks of stocks that are more popular. But there are many different dimensions to be popular.
Mm-hmm.
We've already mentioned two, and that's the capital asset pricing model really focused on that first one, risk.
Right.
And the whole financial literature has so much focused on risk.
Too much focus?
Well, perhaps, because there are other aspects of things that are popular and unpopular.
So we mentioned valuation. We mentioned CAPM. We mentioned liquidity. What other elements do you consider when looking at your popular versus unpopular, let's not call it pairs, but pools of longs and shorts?
So the monograph that we're talking about says popularity, a bridge between classical and behavioral finance.
Ah, so some of the behavioral factors come up also. How do they apply?
So let me give you one more, though, classical factor.
Sure.
I guess if I had to name the three big classical considerations, one of them is risk.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be systematic, but it can have all different dimensions of different types of risk.
Right.
Another one is liquidity. Another one is taxation. Some securities are taxed differently than others.
So different tax treatments between different types of pass-through holdings. What is the third one, tax treatment?
At the most extreme, you can see it if you want to see it directly, would be compare a municipal bond to, say, a corporate bond of the same default and maturity characteristics. The municipal bond is going to have a lower yield.
Right.
But it's going to have... That's because it's popular. It has better tax treatment.
MLPs are treated differently than regular equities, according to the tax man, and that changes how you perceive them in the overall portfolio. Similar to muni bonds, which are also treated differently, a lower yield, effectively net of taxes, turns out to be comparable to a non-municipal bond.
So things that are unpopular, like MLPs, are going to be priced more attractively.
Quite fascinating.
So that's just on the classical side. But then you have the behavioral side. And on the behavioral side, you have things like one of the things we tested in this monograph were brands, brand value. The companies, and there's different ranking systems of how valuable different brands are. But the companies that have the highest brand value, you might imagine those are the companies you would like in your portfolio, right?
No, it would be the opposite. I know where you're going.
Yes.
I'm cheating because I know where you're going, but... Perfect example, in 2018, in the beginning of the year, Apple was one of the it was either one or two in the brand ranking, down 30% since then. And I don't know how far down the list of unpopular brands you go, but I would imagine there's a line that in the sand where you say, on a list of 500 below this number, these unpopular brands start to become attractive. So first question on that is, where is that line? How unpopular does something have to get before it becomes attractive?
It's always relative. I mean, you want to short the most popular names, the most popular brands, and really the unpopular brands. You don't have to go after the brands that are in some sort of scandal or anything. But mainly, most of these brands you've never heard of. You know, they're not well known brands.
So not GE that's run into hard times, but some entity that just seems to have fallen out of favor.
Yes, or just overlooked. Mm-hmm. Things that are overlooked. The stocks that are overlooked are unpopular. Stocks that are in the news all the time are the popular stocks.
Sure.
Now, and the value effect is related to this because stocks, you know, value over the long term outperforms growth.
Mm-hmm.
But the value companies, when you look at those things, those are not great companies. Whereas the growth companies are the companies that are really much more exciting, much better companies.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a difference between buying a great company and buying a great stock.
Uh-huh.
The great stocks are not the great companies. The great stocks are in fact, it's easier to fix a company that has something wrong with it than to improve a company that's everything's going great.
But just isn't popular.
Well, the ones that are great, they're too popular. That's their problem.
So give us one more behavioral measure to consider with popularity.
Well, another one we measured was reputation value.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you another one that's a little more different is tail risk.
Okay.
Any stock that has actually gone through a tail event, a negative event that's gone in its history, recent history, last 5-10 years.
So let's talk about BP and the Gulf of Mexico, or Boeing and the 737 MAX. Those are kind of tail events. What does that tell you about how you would expect the stock to do going forward? Is a stock like Boeing post 737 issue become attractive because of that tail event?
It can, and not necessarily the next month or so, but people are going to remember that tail for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to remember that bad event, and it's going to be the reputation is somewhat permanently damaged. I've actually studied this with one of my co-authors that I named James Shong here, where we looked at tail risk, and it turns out that future tail risk is not so related to past tail events.
Huh, that's interesting.
So if something really went wrong, say Boeing, they'll eventually fix it.
Right.
And get back on track with a lower reputation, but they're not necessarily prone to have another tail event.
Huh. Quite fascinating. We were talking earlier about the difference between academia and real-world application of ideas into actual investments and trades. How often you come across an idea that looks great on paper but just doesn't work, just can't be implemented in a real portfolio?
The problem with real portfolios is they have a lot of they may have trading costs. A lot of the very best ideas have high trading costs, and most of us are not in a position to actually implement these and get rid of those trading costs. There's another problem, though, and that is that the kinds of things that have worked in the past, if you look at it, you do some back testing and you discover mm-hmm. things in the past. Those sorts of things, once they're discovered and known, tend to be heavily invested in, get popular, actually. And right. once they get popular, they get priced out of contention, and they don't have the same sort of payoff. So it's no longer as easy to translate all these ideas that come out of academics and actually make a lot of money from them.
Quite interesting. One of the big topics these days is index funds and the move away from active towards passive. Where do you find yourself in terms of some people seem to think the flow into index funds is distorting the market or at least hurting price discovery? What are we, 15, 20% indexed in the U.S.? What's the impact of that?
I don't actually think it's hurting markets. Actually, the indexes come in so many different forms. You can buy a whole index on, say, the Russell 3000 or the S&P 500, but you can also buy indexes in different forms and ETFs and even mutual funds on by a specific industry or by value stocks or by small cap stocks or by a particular type of stock. So it's if it's really taking a bet when you actually buy that type of stock. Mm-hmm. If you thought, for example, that oil or energy was going to do poorly in the future, in the old days you'd have to, how do I translate under which stocks to avoid and so forth?
It's much easier to express a trade today.
Yes, and that makes the markets more efficient because if we can target our opinions into a trade directly rather than trying to mix it in with some stocks mm-hmm. that are really noisy and not so related to that trade, it makes it very hard to accomplish.
So one of the things I keep hearing from you is it was much easier back then, it's more efficient today. Is this part of the reason why so many active managers seem to be unable to keep up with their benchmark? Have the markets become that efficient?
By definition, though, the market is a zero-sum game before costs mm-hmm. in the sense that if you're going to beat the market, I have to do worse than the market, or we have to sum up to the market collectively, and that's before costs. And after costs, we're going to, on average, do a little bit worse than the market. So this isn't really efficient capital markets. Mm-hmm. This is just a mathematical identity. It's called a zero-sum game.
Right.
And in this case, a zero-relative sum game because it's relative to the market. So we never could all collectively, on average, beat the market. We always had to have most of us actually do a little bit worse than the market on average.
So it's not like Lake Wobegon where all the children are above average? It doesn't work that way?
Well, that's a good analogy because that's what keeps the market going. We all think we're above average.
Mm-hmm.
And if we all this is behavioral, of course.
Sure.
But if we all think we're above average, then of course, we're all willing to play the game, even though some of us are clearly not above average. And
by definition, all of us can't be above average. My favorite question, anytime I'm at a conference and presenting somewhere, I always ask a room full of people, how many of you are above average drivers? Just about every hand in the room goes up. And my response is always, I've been on the road with you folks. Some of you are wrong, because clearly we can all be above average. So let's talk a little bit about what was discussed in Forward Thinker, which was something you wrote for Wealth Manager back in December 2008. You talked about the financial system being restructured following the financial crisis. Have we sufficiently restructured the system to avoid the next crisis, or did we simply restructure it enough to avoid a repeat of the last crisis?
It would be mostly a repeat of the last crisis. Restructuring primarily involves having less leverage, and actually we're also worried about counterparty risk.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, some of that counterparty risk has been fixed. We're getting more leverage back into the system probably
slowly
now.
Slowly but surely it's creeping back in?
Yeah, so I don't see these were as any permanent fixes, and of course, anytime you regulate markets, you also add a lot of encumbrances to the way the markets work. So both good and bad here, that it's I don't see a financial crisis coming soon. Most recessions, by the way, most drops in the market are not really financial crisis, but the one in 2008 was, like the tech bubble crash in 2000 to 2002.
Not a financial crisis.
It wasn't to do with finance, it was just technology, right?
Right. Speaking of behavior, excess sentiment had gotten so enthusiastic, people decided valuation doesn't matter. You could pay any price for these things. Nifty-50, like, it'll all work out, except when eventually doesn't. So clearly not a financial crisis. 87, how do you describe that? Not a financial crisis, really a plumbing and structural issue?
Well, it was a financial crisis. It's just that it only lasted about a week.
So not much. That's not much of a crisis. And I think back to 73, 74. It's just a deep recession, not a financial crisis. The 50s predate me, but when you read the history books, those late 50s, early 60s recessions, they don't seem like crisis. You have to go all the way back to what, 1929 for a previous financial crisis?
Yeah, 1929 and the 1930s were a financial crisis. So we had the big one then, we had the smaller one in 87, and or the limited one in 87, and we had a potentially severe financial crisis in 08, and we got through it, which was very fortunate, but real breakdown of the financial markets.
So that leads to the next question. People have been, some people, especially people on the bond side of the universe, have been very critical about how the Fed intervened in the markets, and they've continued to be critical about low rates being as low as they've been, causing risk assets to rise. What are your thoughts on the job the Fed did during the financial crisis, and how do you think the Fed has done since then?
I think during the financial crisis, the Fed really had to do some special things that they hadn't done. They had to build up their balance sheet, which they had really never done before. It used to be the Fed was just raising and lowering the interest rate, and that was not that didn't do anything after you got down to zero interest rates. So they then had to build up their balance sheet. So I think the Fed did a great job, in my opinion, in helping to avoid that.
Another Great Depression?
A real catastrophe, definitely.
You think it could have been? I think people have forgotten. It's been a decade, and they've already forgotten. Were we on the precipice of another depression similar to the 29 and the 1930s?
We were on the precipice of a financial breakdown. I don't know that it would cause a depression, but it would cause a lot of chaos. And certainly, I'm not clear what it would cause, you know, but we were definitely on the precipice of that financial breakdown, which could have been very severe. As far as what the Fed's done since then, well, I think they could have. We're now 10 years later, and we're now interest rates less than the Fed window, they're really only charging less than 3% at this point. One of the levers the Fed has to protect against recessions is to lower the rate. We can't lower the rate if we never rose it. And so I think they could have done much more, but they were very reluctant to raise rates over this long recovery, which has been now a very long 10-year recovery.
And so we still don't have normalized interest rates, and the Fed is, are they behind the curve, or have they just not gotten us to a place that resembles neutral yet?
The rates are still low, and although they are finally reducing the balance sheet of the Fed, it's still a big balance sheet, so they don't have the same firepower going into any new activity that happens that we had back in 08.
Quite interesting. So let's talk a little bit about annuities, which are somewhat controversial to some people. I don't know if that's really the right descriptor of it. You wrote not too long ago, investors should consider indexed annuities as bond substitutes. Explain what those are and how would that operate in a portfolio?
Well, let me first explain why we might need a bond substitute. Bonds today, at least Treasury yields, are below 3%. Mm-hmm. The 10-year, I looked recently, the 10-year was definitely below 3%. And a return on a bond is the yield plus or minus a capital gain or a loss. Mm-hmm. If yields rise, you have a capital loss on bonds. And I mentioned duration at an earlier time. Essentially, if yields rise 1% and the duration is 10 on a bond, you lose 10% on that bond. Mm-hmm. So there is a potential for actually bonds to have negative returns in the future. If you look at the history of all these yields, we from the 40s on, we had very low yields that rose in 80, 81. They were double digits, but since then, they've been straight down.
33 years of falling interest rates.
And that meant really good returns, because not only did you get those high yields that you started with, but then you got these capital gains. That's probably not going to happen going forward here. We're going to have a low yield, mm-hmm, and a potential capital loss. So I wanted to see what else we could have that would be an alternative to that.
Sure. So short of going back to 1982 and building a bond portfolio, how would an indexed annuity work? Because an annuity is just a wrapper, right? And for the most part, tax deferred. How do indexed annuities work?
Indexed annuities are insurance products, and I have to say that Zebra Capital has indexes, actually a co-branded index with the New York Stock Exchange, mm-hmm, and that index is actually used by an insurance company to in creating a accumulation annuity that I'll mention here. So I have some incentive here to actually.
So you're talking your book, but you're the expert in this space. So we know that you take your academic theory and apply it in practicum, and here's a perfect example of it. So what does that annuity hold, and aren't we kind of doing a little bit of magic, taking something and creating a yield that doesn't have the same parameters of a bond? What is that metamorphosis there?
So what's happening is we take the index. Actually, the insurance company takes this index, and it insures the downside, essentially. So it does this actually by buying options and so forth. So what it means is that an actual person then can buy an index annuity that they get a participation in. Our index is an equity index that has some bonds in it, and it's risk controlled to have a 5% volatility. But they can buy that index with that 5% volatility. The insurance company insures it so that you get equity participation, but you don't lose any money.
So this isn't, we're not taking lead and turning it into gold. This is essentially a hedged equity product that behaves like a bond. Is that a fair way to describe it?
It has roughly the same returns as a bond, mm-hmm, on average, but it doesn't have any losses. The losses are insured, and essentially you have equity participation on the upside, not full equity participation. It's not a substitute for stocks. It's a substitute for bonds that doesn't ever lose money.
So it's a dividend yield plus whatever capital appreciation you get minus the cost of hedging against the downside.
You get the capital appreciation and a participation in the equity market, and of course, no losses on the downside. By having less than 100% participation in the equity market, and by getting the capital appreciation, the insurance company is able to use that to have insure the downside so that there are no losses. So you end up with a distribution of returns that is maybe roughly comparable in terms of returns to a bond market, but has upside but not downside.
Quite fascinating. You're a Chicago guy. You worked with Gene Fama. There are a number of factors that just keep getting discovered. Last count, it was excess of 400, maybe even more than that. What do you think about all these different factors in the textbooks, and how does that work in the real world?
Well, these, say, 400 factors, they're, a lot of them are correlated with each other, so there's not really 400, but there's still many of them, you know. And the way to evaluate it has to do with our monograph again, popularity, because in order for a factor to really pay off and forward over the long term in any way, it has to be unpopular in some sense.
Unpopular.
Yes.
So the popular ones are valuation, quality, momentum. Those are probably the four most popular ones I can think of. You want to go further down the list and find ones that are either overlooked or unpopular.
Well, for example, liquidity.
Sure.
Is something that's inherently popular, and less liquidity is inherently less popular. So if you have a factor based on liquidity, that's likely to pay off. If you have a factor based on risk, they're often likely to pay off because risk is always going to be unpopular, and less risk is always going to be more popular. If you have factors based on, it could be quality, it could be any of these sort of things, it could be value-based. Essentially, if value companies are distressed companies that we don't like, the value premium might be unpopular, I guess. So that's the rationale why you might have a value premium, because if they're the type of companies that we don't like, then they're going to be relatively less demand for them. They're going to be unpopular, but that means that less demand means that they're going to have higher expected returns.
So here we are in 2019. Value has gotten its butt kicked over the past decade by growth. I'm going to interpret what you're saying as implying value as a factor is less popular, but value should expect better returns going forward, or value should have a higher expected return going forward versus the more popular growth.
Yes, I think it does, especially now that we've had this bad period. Because after value does so well, everybody gets excited and starts saying, well, I should be buying value stocks instead of growth stocks. So the question, you always have to ask yourself this question. That's what this monograph is all about.
I can't help but point out that a number of famous and infamous hedge fund managers over the past decade, all of whom kind of came to the public's attention 8, 10, 12 years ago, the more popular they got and the more capital they got, the worse their performance seems to be. Is this the same sort of issue where suddenly popularity just exceeds their ability to manage that capital? Or is there something about, hey, that's way late in the cycle. By the time it gets popular, it's just too late.
Well, it's probably both of that. Certainly when they get a lot of money, that their particular idea, they put a lot of money behind it. They're putting too much money behind it, and then they're moving the price themselves, and then that makes it overvalued, and then too popular, in our words. So too popular could be overvalued. Too popular could be just classical types of things like risk or liquidity. But popularity is the thing that ties everything together. That's why I guess I'm so excited about our new monograph here, because it's not only it ties all these premiums together that people are talking about, say the 400 premiums and which ones might work, and it also ties in the link because we were evolving into behavioral finance and classical finance as being different fields to some extent. This ties them back together again. So I'm really excited about the whole approach here.
And I'll include a link to that white paper on the write-up about this so people can find it. We have been speaking with Roger Ibbotson, professor of finance at the Yale School of Management and chairman of Ibbotson Associates, as well as chairman and CIO of Zebra Capital Management. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and check out the podcast extras, where we keep the tape rolling and continue discussing all things factor and popularity related. You can find that at iTunes, Overcast, Stitcher, Bloomberg.com, wherever finer podcasts are found. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at MIBpodcast@Bloomberg.net. Check out my daily column on Bloomberg.com/opinion. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome to the podcast. Roger, thank you so much. I don't know what to call you, Professor Ibbotson. Roger, what's your preferred...
Well, with a person like you, Barry, I'll call you Barry. You should call me Roger.
Okay. I feel like I'm definitely punching above my weight in this conversation. But this has been just really fantastic stuff. I know I've been following your career and your research and writings for... my whole career in finance, and I've been very much looking forward to this conversation. So let's jump to our favorite questions. I ask these of all our guests, and some of these are especially resonant for different listeners. Let's start with I used to ask this question just as a sound check for the audio engineer, and the answers were so fascinating that I've started asking all the guests this question. So what was the first car you ever owned, year, make, and model?
Well, it was a 1961 Plymouth Valiant, light blue, and I was a junior, I guess just a starting senior in college at Purdue, and I really loved that car, I got to say. It looked kind of a sporty-looking car, and so it was a really...
Two-door or four-door?
It was a four-door car, but it was still a very... very sporty looking car, and it was great fun, although unfortunately I didn't get to keep it that long.
I kind of remember the Valiant. I'm trying to remember if that was like a Dodge Dart, similar shape, sort of a big long hood and a big long
no
trunk.
It's actually a little bit smaller than that.
It was
a very sporty looking car. It wasn't like that
but back in the day when Plymouth made some pretty substantial sports cars.
Yeah, they didn't make the sports cars. But unfortunately, that car, my first job after I got my MBA, so I had that car for 3 years. I'm a senior and then 2 years as an MBA student. But I worked on a cattle ranch, actually, my first job. In Nevada.
Uh-huh. So I was going to ask, my next question is, what is the most important thing we don't know about Roger Ibbotson? But before I get to that, how do you go from the University of Chicago and an MBA in finance to a cattle ranch?
Well, I thought I had an offer, so I took it, and I thought it looked like a good opportunity to do something really great. And but I was out of my element. I was fired at the end of the summer.
So you weren't trading cattle futures. You were actually on a horse within a ranch.
Well, it was more like trucks and planes.
Okay.
Let me tell you, a car does not last on a cattle ranch very long because they're all dirt roads,
right?
And the car was just covered thick with dust, and
every
bump and so forth. The transmission went out, and all the things. So that was my car had that kind of ending life there, and I didn't work out either at the cattle ranch, and so I actually. Ended that job and put it on my resume as a summer job.
That's pretty hilarious. So I given that, I'm reluctant to ask the next question, but what's the most important thing people don't know about Roger Ibbotson?
I would actually say, though, I'll take it all the way to the present.
Sure.
That I'm not, I've of course been working in finance all these years, but I'm actually very interested in long-term data and time over time and so forth. And I'm getting very interested and I might be writing, I'm at least researching whether to write on the subject of long history going forward and back, essentially. Perhaps even starting with the Big Bang. And then really for more predictive purposes, though.
Huh.
And long-term kind of predictions and what's going to happen to humanity and so forth. So that's one of the things. You'll have to interview me a couple years later.
When this book comes out, you're absolutely welcome back. We'd love to talk about that. So tell us about, and I'm afraid to even ask this question, but I have to, because I know who's coming up in the answer. Who were your early mentors?
Well, it is the University of Chicago people with the
Fama, Merton, Markowitz. Who else is on that run?
Well, it was Myron Scholes and Fisher Black, and Merton Miller and Gene Fama. They're all my early mentors. Yes,
that's an incredible lineup. What about investors? What investors influence the way you think about taking theory and applying it in the real world?
You know, they weren't literally investors, because I have to say that getting grounded in efficient capital market theory gives you a whole approach to investing. And instead of starting out with imagining that every stock you imagine is unrelated to the price in some way, if you start out with the fact that if you know nothing about a company or a security, it's the price is the kind of the best guess of what its value is. And so that's such a dramatic approach. Even if you're looking for inefficiency for the market, it's such a changes your whole way of approaching everything and thinking about everything, because you, instead of for example, as a portfolio manager, you could do nothing and you might do fine. You know, it's, you don't have to literally trade every day to make things work. It's a matter of you only want to trade when you really do have the edge that you're actually going to add value. So one of the things I always think of, and I've managed companies and I've managed stocks, and I think stocks in some way manage themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you start out from the belief that the price is a fair estimation of the value, that should really take care of itself.
That's right. That's sort of the key. I mean, once you sort of know that, your stocks are managing themselves, but then you try to improve on that.
Right.
But your people don't manage themselves.
That's right.
So it's much harder to manage people than it is to manage stocks once you understand this principle. If you don't understand that principle, though, managing stock markets, you've got hundreds of thousands of stocks. You've got hundreds or thousands or whatever. You've got all these stocks, mm-hmm. and you're trying to think out, is this one overvalued or undervalued? Or if you have to attack it that way, you can quickly get overwhelmed at the situation. So it's just a principle that so much simplifies the process.
Starting with the assumption that, hey, most stocks are going to be more or less priced relative to their value. It's a good starting place. All right, let's get to everybody's favorite question. I get emails about this all the time. Tell us some of your favorite books. Well, by the way, I will include your books when this goes live. I will include a list of all your published books. So tell us some of the favorite books that you've read of other authors.
Yeah, I want to say, of course, I'm not going to promote my own books. I always love my own books, I guess.
Who doesn't? What author doesn't?
But because I've been looking at long-term things, I've been...
I know where you're going to go. Go ahead. Let's hear it.
For example, there's this Yuval Harari, who's been writing on Sapiens and then the prediction...
Homo Deus, right.
...of the future on that. Mm-hmm. I'm reading that. I've been reading like Steven Pinker's, I think it's called Our Better Angels.
Angels of Our Nature, yep.
Yes, about how we're changing over time and so forth, mm-hmm. and how we're less violent and so forth. David Christian is an author, and he's Australian. Well, he's not really Australian. He's been all over the world, but I think he's teaching in Australia at this point. But he's written a book and done a lot of electronic courses on big history, mm-hmm. which is looking at history from the start all the way out into the future.
Is that the name of the book, Big History?
Well, he has a book that's his most thorough book is Maps in Time.
Okay, quite interesting.
From about 10-15 years ago.
You have any other books you want to mention? Because I'm going to circle back to something you said earlier.
Well, I could name many...
Keep
books
going.
Like this subject.
Give us one or two more.
One that I'm just finished was Johan Norberg out of Sweden wrote a book on progress and how mm-hmm. how we're getting better off in lots of different dimensions and so forth. So these are all subjects that are of interest to me. I don't think it's all good news, though, of course, because at Yale, for example, the recent Nobel prize winner Bill Nordhaus really worked on pollution and so forth, and how global warming and so forth. So lots of other things are going on. I'm not saying it's all good news. I'm interested in the overall effect, though, and trying to understand this. So I am interested in long-term history, and I'm always interested in long-term forecasting.
Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by the two Harari books because Sapiens is so interesting, and while some of it's got a little bit of a negative cast, generally speaking, it's the history of progress, even though along the way he kind of annotates it with all these, farms and cities are where diseases began. But it's not a completely bleak picture. The Homo Deus book is a little more negative looking forward than Sapiens sort of had this wide-eyed wonder to it, and which did not come across in Homo Deus. I'm curious as to your take on the two books.
Well, I sense what you're saying, and I must say humans have been a remarkable species, and I'm always just amazed at the fact that we actually can understand the start of the universe, and we can understand.
Well, maybe we do. We're not sure we do yet.
Well, we know a lot about it. It's amazing, a lot about it, mm-hmm. And we also know. I mean, that's how they got the Higgs boson, for example,
sure.
And all that kind of thing. They could predict these sort of things. And we also know something about the scale of the universe.
Which is astonishing.
And this has all happened in the last 300 or 400 years, since Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo and so forth. These things, we went from nowhere, thinking the Earth was the center of everything, to actually understanding everything. That's at the macro level. But at the micro level, we also understand how, of course, atoms and electrons and
quarks and gluons
and DNA and so forth. So our species is just has amazing accomplishments but I don't know where we're. So you have to wonder then, given all this huge acceleration of knowledge and actually collection of knowledge that just keeps building on itself, where does that go?
Right. Especially the past 50 years, we're in a golden age of physics. I mean, the past 50 years and then the past decade, quite astonishing the sort of progress we've made. All that said, the Big Bang Theory is still a very preliminary theory. We don't understand the whole inflationary expansion that took place. We still don't understand, if we're measuring the universe right, how much dark matter is out there, what are we missing, what are we not seeing, why are galaxies accelerating away from each other no matter what direction you look. I'm fascinated by that. I like you are, I share just a genuine astonishment about that. There was a book that came out about a decade ago that you might appreciate if you're working your way forward from the Big Bang, called The Rare Earth Thesis, which basically says, well, life is probably common in the galaxy because in the universe, because every galaxy has all the fundamental building blocks, hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, etc. But intelligent life is really, really rare, and it's a whole series of incredibly unusual events that lead to a planet like this that's stable enough for billions of years, for long enough for intelligent, technologically advanced life to develop. And I'm just intrigued by that, sort of circling back to the original pre-Enlightenment. Oh, no, it's just humans. The rest of the universe doesn't matter. The whole universe was just created by God for us, and maybe there's actually some, for completely different reasons, theoretical basis for that thesis from a physics approach. But I digress far off. It's not the best written book, but it's a fascinating concept. If you're enjoying all the modern astrophysics work, and I'm sure you've come across Brian Greene and his string theory work and other stuff, I'm endlessly fascinated by that. I'm just intrigued by that stuff.
So one of the great things about being a professor is you get to study whatever you want, and you share this fascination with me with this, and now I really can kind of work on this now, you see. So
Do you ever pick up the phone at Yale and say, oh, so-and-so is in the astrophysics department, let me get him on the phone, and you have access to all these folks who can steer you in certain directions?
I'm starting to do that. I hadn't been doing that, you know, because I had been pretty focused over the, as you say, I've better have a broad breadth of activities here, but they hadn't gotten into this sort of thing. Now I'm getting into all the other arms of the university, mm-hmm. and I find it really exciting I'm applying the kind of things I've always done because I always was interested in history and data.
Right.
And
you're always taking it to the next level.
And always interested in making projections and and so forth. And now I'm just trying to broaden this out. So this is a great, I guess at this point I'll say it's a hobby, I'll try to make it into, I don't think I'll make money from this, of course.
Well, it's tough to do that. So it makes me want to ask you the question, universal entropy, are we eventually just going to dissipate or the big crunch and it all starts over again?
You really do want the big question, don't you?
I come prepared.
Well, of course, entropy eventually dissipates everything, but one of the things that the universe is built on is complexity, mm-hmm. and even though you have this overall entropy going on, which is spreading everything out and dissipating, you have gravity's been one of the big things, pulling parts of things together.
Right.
So at the same time everything's dissipating, obviously we are getting more and more complex, and that's certainly, humans are an example of that.
Sure.
So the world is getting more complex, not less complex, despite mm-hmm. despite the second law of thermodynamics.
So I'm fascinated by the concept, and I wish I can remember where I read it, that, and this will be the last astrophysics part of our conversation, the idea that nothingness is inherently unstable, and the Big Bang comes around that you can't have nothingness forever. Nothingness eventually just explodes into something else because of its inherent instability. And that's a little mind-blowing to me. Us humans can barely conceptualize it, but it's a fascinating concept. How does a universe come out of nothingness? And the answer is, well, maybe nothingness just is so unstable that it has no choice but to create a universe. I'm fascinated by that.
So in my case, I'm going to limit this a little more.
You're going to keep it limited to just the universe, right?
Well, I mean, I may look at the next 100 years or the next 1,000 years or something like that. So or maybe mainly our planet, you know, instead of the whole universe and so forth. So, but they're all related. I mean, it certainly, having some understanding of the big picture helps you understand still the very big picture.
Quite interesting. So let me move forward away from the universe and ask you this. Tell us about a time you failed and what you learned from the experience.
You know, I failed quite a bit in my early days. And my father was in the heating and air conditioning business. Mm-hmm. And had I been more mechanically inclined,
you would have gone into that field?
Yes, that's certainly
Well,
true.
Thank goodness you weren't, because we need you here in finance doing what you're doing.
And then even when I when I went to college, my father said to take engineering because the corporate presidents are mostly engineers. That was true after World War II, but it's not true today.
Right.
And so I took engineering, but I really couldn't handle all the hands-on stuff of even engineering. And so I got into math and physics as my major. So I needed to be something more abstract. But when I got to math, it got too abstract for me,
right.
And I couldn't even handle that. And so I had to find a niche. And finance is actually the perfect niche. It's kind of abstract, but it's not as abstract as abstract. I actually try to make something like abstract things practical. That's mm-hmm. been my key, I guess, that piece in between the fully abstract and the practical and blend them together.
That's your sweet spot, right in the middle between the two of them. So what do you do for fun when you're not contemplating the universe? What does Roger Ibbotson do to keep himself entertained?
Well, I mean, I I have a family, and so I have two sons here in Brooklyn, and great to get together with them. Of course, I exercise and all that, and I go hiking and all that. But to me, the most fun, and it even connects my family and everything, is the world of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's what's so great about being a professor. You essentially are told, do what you want. You have to come out with something once in a while, but do whatever you want.
Every once in a while. Educate the kids if you can. But
Also, I actually do love teaching, too. Mm-hmm. So the teaching is really exciting to me and stimulating. So it's a great combination. So it's not that I'm a workaholic, because
mm-hmm.
I'm really not a workaholic, but it's about the most fun you could have. And even when I talk to my sons, for example, we're talking about economics all the time, and it's an exciting area, and not only just economics, but about the universe or whatever, you know, talking about all these ideas. So the world of ideas is really fun.
Quite charming. So you mentioned teaching. If a millennial or a recent college grad came to you and asked for career advice about the world of finance, what sort of advice would you give them?
Well, it starts with follow your passion and follow your interests, of course. Don't just try to maximize money here. And if they're going to be likely successful if they are following their passion. So that's definitely what I would tell them to do. Fortunately, finance is a pretty well-paid profession,
mm-hmm.
so most people end up doing reasonably well, and that's not. I'm glad that happens, because I guess it all worked out great for me. So,
and our final question: what is it that you know about the world of investing today that you wish you knew 40 years ago when you were coming out of your MBA program and just getting started?
And that question, I'm not going to really answer the way you asked it, because, in fact, I did know. and the whole idea of coming out of understanding what equilibrium is and how prices are formed, and
mean reversion,
and how starting with market efficiency and so forth, that really changed my life and how I approach everything. And made everything easier.
So you were fortunate to figure out at the beginning of your career what a lot of people don't figure out until towards the end of their career.
Yeah, so it's not like I don't know what to tell you about what I didn't know, because I actually did know these important concepts. And they actually had a wonderful impact on me.
Well, that's quite fascinating. Roger Ibbotson, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with Roger Ibbotson. He is a professor in the practice emeritus of finance at the Yale School of Management, as well as founder and chairman of Ibbotson Associates and chairman and chief investment officer of Zebra Capital Management. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Be sure and write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Check out some of the other 248 such previous conversations that we've had. If you look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, Bloomberg.com, wherever finer podcasts are sold, you can see the rest of all of our previous conversations. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack staff that helps put this podcast together each week. Medina Parwana is my producer/audio engineer. Taylor Riggs is our booker. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. Michael Batnick is our head of research. I have to thank Charlie Pallett this week for giving us his desk and his recording studio because of my snafu with daylight savings time and the UK. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.